BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. To you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to you in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston, those all over the world, including our new audience in South America. We have Simon Chapman in the studio today. Simon is secretary of the Bristol branch of the National Union of Journalists. He's also a freelance photographer and is going to talk about the police and the possible prosecution of journalists who take photos of police for use in the media. We also have an up-to-date report on the Gaza convoy in relation to Mohamed El Haddad, the Bristol University academic, who we interviewed 3 weeks ago, who is on a journey to provide supplies to Gaza and Palestine. June Wentland is back in the studio with us today. June is a writer and publisher, and she's going to read one of her short stories. Malcolm Grieve reads another chapter of The History of the Mafia. Anthea Page sends us a report on part two of the mines at Potosi in Bolivia. This week, she's going down into the mines with the recorder. Rachel Evanson's back with her guitar with a new song, Circus People. We're so busy this week, in fact, we've had to drop part three of the Diana interview. That's not a priority this week, but we will be playing it next week. And you can also hear Jeff Sparks rounding us off with What's Going On. I'm John Peters Coleman, the presenter of this week's show.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And I'd like to introduce immediately our studio guest, Simon Chapman. Hello.
Hello there. Yeah, I'm Simon Chapman. I'm a press photographer, a member of the National Union of Journalists. However, I just want to emphasise I'm speaking in a personal capacity, although I will be mentioning NEJ initiatives.
Okay. Well, the police have just got powers under terrorism legislation to stop people taking photographs of them. They say that some of these pictures may be of use to terrorists. But with CCTV all around us, is the balance of rights tipping away from the public and towards a police state? A very potent phrase. Do you think we're tipping towards a police state?
That is a fear of both members of the public and some members of the media. Photographers are particularly worried by this new Section 76 of the Counter-Terrorism Act 2008, which adds to the Terrorism Act 2000 by introducing a new offence of eliciting or attempting to elicit information about members of the armed forces, intelligence services or police. Such information, which might be is likely to be useful to a person committing or preparing an act of terrorism, is covered by this new act. But how do you define information of a kind likely to be useful?
So is this a case of a sort of a good law, and this is scaremongering that could be used for purposes for which it's very unlikely to be, or is the law fairly clear about what is actually being made illegal?
Well, it's not clear to me at all. I mean, previously, there usually isn't a problem with taking pictures of the police at public events, football matches, incidents, accidents, demonstrations even. Now it's less clear. A lot of the photographers were worried, and there was a big demonstration outside Scotland Yard on the 16th of February when this came into force. 300 press photographers turned up to just show that they wanted to be able to take pictures of the police.
What do the police think about this, do you know?
Well, quite interestingly, the Metropolitan Police Federation, which represents members of the Metropolitan Police, and I suppose is the closest they get to a trade union, has come out on its website with an article saying, "Do not make us the secret police." They share the concerns of the media that poorly drafted anti-terrorist legislation, and I quote, that's a quote from them, could be used to justify unwarranted interference in their lawful activities, meaning the lawful activities of press photographers. They think that the Section 76 law is open to wide interpretation, or rather misinterpretation, their words again. And they're worried about, for instance, the 2012 Olympics, how they would be expected to police such an event where there will be an awful lot of cameras about, many of them tourists, but also, of course, the media.
If the police are themselves worried, if both the police and the photographers are worried, where's the problem? By the sounds of it, it's unlikely that a policeman's going to arrest you.
Well, I hope not, and it's somewhat reassuring that the Metropolitan Police Federation are worried too. But it does beg the question of why this law has been introduced. I haven't seen any explanation of it. In certain situations, it could be wheeled out by the authorities or perhaps senior officers to restrict the freedom of the press the public.
This is now officially a law. It is already in action. Are you aware of what public consultation was held? I mean, did you know about it beforehand?
There was some knowledge of it late last year, but by that time it had already been passed. It just wasn't in effect. And the first I'd heard about it, was basically the end of last year. I don't know if there was any public consultation on that act.
What about journalists more generally? A lot of your colleagues, is there a fairly widespread acceptance that this is a bad law, or do you know of people that may think it's a good law?
I haven't heard of anyone saying it's a good law at the moment. It hasn't affected me personally as yet. I'm not aware of anyone being arrested under Section 76 yet.
Do you know of anybody who's actually been stopped at all by the police for taking pictures in any way that's connected with this law?
Not Section 76. I mean, people have been stopped under the Terrorism Act, usually under stop and search powers of the Terrorism Act 2000.
What laws are already in place that might limit your ability to take photographs of the police, possibly in action, already, before this law came into place? What's changed?
A very specific naming of the police. It now, the feeling is that any picture of the police, you know, might potentially be useful to somebody, you know, with terrorism intentions. But previously there weren't any laws against taking pictures of the police, as far as I'm aware. Certainly not in public places.
So, in effect, if there were a connection between you and terrorism, it would be perfectly possible to stop you or possibly arrest you or take legal action with using some other act which is in no way related to this?
Yes, well, under the Terrorism 2000 Act and possibly other acts before that. I don't know, I'm not a legal expert, but...
So, essentially, you're saying it's basically a useless law as opposed to a law that's possibly likely to be proactively used?
I'd hesitate to use the word useless. I don't know why they've decided to sort of make the 2000... It is an amendment to the 2000 Terrorism Act, but I don't know why they've bothered to make this very specific amendment with Section 76, why they couldn't just leave the previous act as it was. Although in itself that was very broad and could have caught any kind of activity if it was thought to be useful for terrorism purposes.
Okay, so aside from the confusion about the purpose of the law, do you sort of feel actively threatened by this law that's come into action? Do you fear that this is definitely moving further towards a possibility of a future police state?
Well, the fear is that it will be misused beyond sort of obvious terrorism-related incidents. So, yes, and that's a worry. I hope it doesn't work out like that.
OK. Is there anything that photographers are going to be doing in the near future or that they're doing now? Sort of any campaigns that are in action at the moment that you know of? Or is this just a sort of an underlying underground concern?
Well, I mean, it's not particularly underground. As I said, there was a big public demonstration at Scotland Yard. The NUJ have come out with their concerns. The Metropolitan Police Federation themselves have come out with their concerns. I think everybody's going to be watching the space and seeing what happens.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in today, Simon Chapman. And it was very interesting to hear about that, and I'm sure we'll be keeping an eye on what's going on with that scenario. That was Simon Chapman, freelance photographer and secretary of the NUJ Bristol branch, although he was, of course, speaking purely in his own personal capacity. Don't worry, if you're not a terrorist, you can, if you choose, just carry on taking pictures of the police, just like we always have been doing, because, of course, it's not illegal to take a picture in a public space.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. or go onto our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our first feature by Tony Gosling is an update on the Gaza convoy. Dialect has been following a growing convoy of vehicles full of medical aid and food from Britain to Gaza in Palestine. Mohammed El Haddad came into the studio 3 weeks ago, just before he set off, and he's now travelled most of the 5,000 miles down through France, Spain and Morocco. When Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to him on Wednesday, he was in Libya, close to the Egyptian border. First on the phone from Libya, though, is one of Mohammed's co-drivers, Ibrahim Madrisi, from Edinburgh, who describes the reception they got crossing from Tunisia into Libya.
The reception in Libya was fantastic. Coming through the border was very straightforward. It was very quick, and there was a great reception on at the border itself as we came through. They had the band, you know, the army band with the bagpipes and the trumpets and all that. So they paraded us through, and then they took us through, and we stopped off for some food at the border. While they made a speech, there was a meeting, and there was a speech given. And then after that was at the border. They took the passport. It was very straightforward as well. It was very quick. It was a very good speech, and they donated a few truckloads, actually. I think about 100 trucks, big trucks, trailer trucks, full of goods as well to take with us for the end of the journey. And then after that, they took us to a city just before Tripoli, where we stayed the night, and there was another reception there. But that was the reception at the Tripoli was very good. It was a very good reminder when we hit Libya, when we hit the city. It was a very good reminder for why we were actually doing the trip, because there was a lot of pictures of what had happened and the pictures of the demolition that had occurred in the 13 or the 21 days at the beginning of the year in Gaza, and a lot of the pictures of the dead bodies and the things that had happened. And it was a very good reminder of why we're going and what the purpose of this convoy is, to take this aid and to draw attention basically to the catastrophe that's happening in this town or country or whatever you'd like to call it, called Gaza. It's warm, the people are very friendly. The people that haven't been here before, I've been very surprised, because the people I'm travelling with haven't been here before. And they were very surprised, and they were very impressed of the reception and the way the people have responded to this convoy coming through, and just to the hospitality in general. It's more like any other country, to be honest with you, just very warm. And in the desert, obviously, because you can feel the desert. Well, as you get out of Tripoli heading towards the Egyptian border, it's just been desert, you know, like, so it's one road cutting through. And there's literally nothing around you. It's just the Sahara Desert, but it's rough terrain desert. It's not the mountain dunes. It's a rough, hard, flat ground desert. And it's just a straight road you can see for miles. You know, you can see the end of the road at the horizon. You just carry on down.
So, how many people, how many vehicles in this convoy now?
I think there's over 300, I heard the other day there.
And that compares to how many that set off from London originally?
I think there's 100 vehicles or 150 vehicles that have been added on.
108
vehicles have been added on
from
the Gaddafi Foundation, from the Gaddafi charity. I'll put you on to Mohammed. He's just come
right into
the car, actually.
Okay.
We've been welcomed, you know, warmly by those people. House is very good. Accommodation was brilliant. You know, public engagement that we never had before. We basically asked them whatever we want, and everything has been provided to us. Even the escort has been very kind with us. It's not like other countries as well. So whatever we need is, you know, available.
What's your accommodation like? Where are you staying overnight?
It basically depends on where we are. The first day we arrived, we were in the scout, you know, campus. And the second day we were in a sea village. Very nice location. And the third night was in a hotel and a mosque. And the fourth night, which is the last night, we were in the desert, in the Sahara Desert. And tonight, we've been asked not to get into Egyptian border because they did not allow us today. They won't allow us today to cross the border. They want us to come tomorrow. So we are now about 15 kilometers from the Egyptian border. And we had to stay in this location, which is the Sahara Desert.
So the plan is to go into Egypt tomorrow, and you'll be in Gaza in a week's time. Is that right?
Possibly 4 days, possibly by Monday maximum. We're just crossing the border because we are not really welcomed in Egypt to be engaged with the public. We're going to just use the motorway straight away to Gaza.
Do you think that the Egyptian government are a little bit sensitive about you passing through Egypt on the way to Gaza?
I think so. They are quite sensitive about this issue. And they'll try not to allow us to get through the cities like what we had in Libya. We were just right in the middle of the town with the public. But, you know, in Egypt, I doubt that we're going to be able to see anyone.
So, possibly a more bumpy ride in Egypt awaits them over the next few days, but we'll find out more next week. Anyway, that was Mohammed El Haddad there, the Bristol University academic who's left his life behind doing his PhD and his wife and his kids, and is now on his way to Gaza in Palestine. It's worth mentioning that the British newspapers have been censoring news of the convoy. On Tuesday this week, Mark Steele's column in The Independent did not appear. He wrote an article all about the arrest of 9 convoy members by Lancashire Police 3 weeks ago, the last of whom have now just been released without charge. If you put the Mark Steele article The Independent didn't publish into your search engine, you will find it. Tony said earlier on, apparently, Mohammed El Haddad's wife has had non-stop calls to her house, and she's just basically been a human answering machine, endlessly answering people's calls, asking after his progress. And we all wish him the best of luck.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Rachel's going to play a new song, and this is called Circus People.
He came from Kent, he hated lumpy porridge. He owned a business selling half-rate storage. That's where we first did meet. He asked me why I had a colourful van. I said, cos I'm an entertaining woman. And then he looked at me, he smiled sweetly. I wanna be like circus people. I wanna do whatever circus people do. I wanna sleep with circus people. I wanna sleep with circus people like you. I didn't understand. I just smiled and held his hand. I took him to a magic party where everyone was kinda crazy and naughty. He said, wow, what do I do now? Up came a man riding a unicycle. When introduced, he said his name was Michael. Said, come join me, we'll have some fun for free. You wanna live like circus people. You wanna do whatever circus people do. You wanna sleep with circus people. Wanna sleep with circus people like me. So I thrust a knife into his hand and said, juggle this if you can. Get crazy hair, maybe dreadlocks. Try escaping from a box. Ride a bike across a wire. Or even master breathing fire. And if you can get it right, and if you can do it every night, you better give your mum a call and tell her now you're off the wall. Yeah, you can be like circus people. You can do whatever circus people do. You can be like circus people. But I'm not gonna sleep with you. Even if there's nothing else to do. Travel round with the circus people. 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 Oh.
Thank you very much, Rachel. She's now got a MySpace page set up, myspace.com/littlemissanarchy. And if you want to go and see her, there are some interesting bits of information. The Cabelli Co-op, which is on Robertson Road in Easton, they have an open mic night every Friday about 9 in the evening. And you can go along to that and see her there, perhaps. And on Tuesday, the 10th of March, Verbal Remedies open mic in aid of people and planet. And that's at Halo, and that starts at about 8 p.m. It's time once again for another chapter of The History of the Mafia, abridged especially for dialect radio and read by the actor Malcolm Greaves.
The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. The English love a good villain, said Charlie Richardson. Some of his contemporaries, usually the ones who didn't find themselves with electrodes attached to their private parts, have called Charlie Richardson one of the cleverest English criminals of the 20th century. When it comes to understanding the English psyche and its fascination with crime, his insight is very accurate. In Britain, there's always been a strong tendency to romanticise crime. A gang of robber bandits led by a local outlaw became the folk heroes Robin Hood and his Merry Men. In just over 250 years since his hanging in York, the sadistic highwayman Dick Turpin has become the hero of a television series and been used to sell everything from beer to porcelain. This mythologising is not restricted to historical figures, however. Just 3 decades after his release from prison for an assortment of violent crimes, Mad Frankie Fraser is enough of a celebrity to appear on a television game show and has joined the ranks of iconic names in British organised crime from the second half of the 20th century, who, like the Krays, hold a firm grip on the public's imagination. This British love affair with outlaws has often obscured the vicious and horrific nature of organised crime in the United Kingdom. Organised gangs of Essex criminals bringing in contraband from the continent, underage girls from Europe being shipped to London and forced into prostitution, widespread corruption amongst the police, high-placed professionals consorting with street thieves to commit fraud, groups of foreign thieves making London their base. The current state of organised crime in England has uncanny echoes of the past 500 years of British criminal history. In 1739, a group of criminals organised under the name of the Essex Gang were smuggling contraband liquor and tobacco. Led by Dick Turpin, they also engaged in highway robbery and housebreaking. Today, organised gangs of Essex criminals are still heavily involved in duty trafficking, the only real change being that they are also likely to be involved in smuggling narcotics. Victorian Britain was rife with child prostitution. The common belief that sex with a virgin cured syphilis was a significant element of this sickening trade of the import of young girls from France by foreign criminal groups. As in many modern-day cases, the girls usually aged around 12 were either sold by their parents or persuaded to leave home with the promise of well-paid jobs as maids in England. Once across the Channel, they were raped, beaten and terrorised into working as prostitutes. The only difference with 21st century Britain is that the girls are now usually older and come from Eastern Europe, Russia and Africa. The rampant collusion with criminals exposed as existing in certain sections of Scotland Yard in the 1970s, and more recently amongst certain detectives in the West Midlands, is just a shadow of the activities of Jonathan Wild. In 18th century London, Wild was known as the thief-taker general. His public image of a successful policeman hid the fact that for many years he was running one of the largest professional criminal gangs in English history. He eventually went to the gallows at Tyburn on May the 24th, 1725. Current newspaper stories of how professional criminals use street gangs to obtain credit cards and other documentation that allows them to steal people's private identities and commit massive fraud are old hat. James Townsend Soward, an outwardly respectable barrister, used gangs of child pickpockets to steal chequebooks in order to perpetrate a raft of frauds until he was transported to Australia in 1857. England has never been short of convenient groups of immigrants to blame for their crime problems, too. Sicilian secret societies with criminal elements operated in London in the 1850s. From the Victorian period right up to the trial of Brilliant Chang in 1924, the Limehouse area of East London was notorious for Chinese triad activity that centred around opium and white slavery. Recent waves of immigration had brought with them both new organised crime groups and new scapegoats. When you examine the origins of organised crime in England, it is impossible to ignore the self-evident truth that wherever Britain has created prohibition and a repressive tax regime, it has created organised crime. Whilst British legislators missed out on anything like the grand mistake of the 18th Amendment that brought prohibition to America, the advent of the Second World War created the perfect conditions for organised crime to flourish in Britain. The influx of American GIs saw the vice and pornography trade, especially in Soho, boom, while rationing and countless prohibitions created a massive black market. Add to this fact that the majority of the established police were called up into the armed forces, and it was a perfect time for those in the British underworld to expand their criminal operations. Infamous gangster Mad Frankie Fraser summed up the wartime experience by saying, "The war years were the best years of my life. Paradise. I'll never forgive Hitler for losing the war." The echoes of the past create the future. Britain may never have seen the Sicilian Mafia take a firm hold on its shores, but with the Sabinis, it did have its own Italian mob. The organised crime gangs of the Crays and the Richardsons were not the first to be led by sharp-suited brothers who ruled London's underworld through an unhealthy combination of violence and fear. The Sabrini brothers came from Saffron Hill in London, an area that has been known as the Italian Quarter, or Little Italy, since the 1840s. Born of a Scottish mother and Italian father, the Sabinis grew up in the late 1890s and early 1900s. The area they lived in was already infamous for its gangs of up to 30 thieves and villains. Gang war was rife, with many of the clashes over the control of illegal street bookmaking pitches and protection of local businesses. With good money to be made from these rackets, it is not surprising that a life of crime was such an enticing prospect to poverty-stricken boys short on legitimate opportunities, but endowed with natural strength and cunning minds. Ulano Darby Sabini was born in 1889. He was a talented boxer, but gave up his career in the ring to provide protection to bookmaker Harry Sullivan. He quickly formed a gang around himself and began offering protection and debt recovery services to other bookmakers. At the core of the Sabini gang were his four brothers, Harry Boy, Joseph, Fred and George. They gained a reputation for extreme violence and became known to both their gangland enemies and the police as the Italian mob. In England in the 1920s and 1930s, bookmaking was illegal at anywhere other than a racetrack. The vast sums that were bet at racecourses attracted gangs of organised criminals. Running protection rackets against the legitimate bookmakers at racetracks could net a gang up to £5,000 a day, a princely sum in the 1920s. It is no surprise, therefore, that the Sabini brothers' Italian mob wanted some of the action. Referred to by the police as racecourse terrorists, the razor-wielding Sabinis began to carve themselves a territory. To begin with, they didn't have things all their own way. Since 1910, even the southern racetracks, such as Newbury, Kempton Park and Epsom, were considered the turf of gangs originating in Birmingham. These gangs were led by Billy Kimber and Andrew Towney, and known as the Brummagem Boys. In 1921, fierce battles between the Sabinis and Kimber's gang raged across the racetracks, with Darby Sabini having to shoot his way out of trouble on more than one occasion. Even teaming up with a gang from Leeds and bringing in the feared London gang, the Titanics, could not save Kimber. After being shot outside Darby Sabini's house, Kimber gave up and returned to the Midlands, allowing the Sabinis to dominate the racetrack rackets throughout England. Not satisfied with just this source of income, they moved into running nightclubs and gambling dens in London. As a result of this, in 1922, they fell out with former allies, the Cortese Gang. Despite such rivalries, the Sabinis remained kings of organised crime until 1936, when they lost the famous Battle of Lewes against another London gang led by the White family. While the Second World War created the biggest opportunity for making money that British villains had ever been given, for the Sabinis it marked the final end of their criminal enterprises, when they, like many Anglo-Italians, were interned as enemy aliens.
That was The History of the Mafia, read by the actor Malcolm Greaves.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our intrepid reporter, Anthea Page,
When is she ever not intrepid? I've never seen her not being intrepid. Has been travelling around South America. This week in part two, we visit the Candelaria mine at the Unificado Cooperative with an ex-miner tourist guide. The cooperative was formed after the 1952 revolution in Bolivia when Paz Estenssoro was called back from exile to take control of the country. Over 8 million black slaves and indigenous people were known to have perished in the Potosi mines since the Spanish created them over four centuries ago. From level 1, we take you down to level 2, where the mining museum is situated, and then onto level 3, where the trucks take the minerals to the refinery.
Since 16th, 17th centuries, here there are 8 levels. We are not going to visit all the levels here, the place, the areas, is because it's too difficult and dangerous, even for the miners. We are going to visit 3 levels. And we are going to go down like mines by steps and ladders. Okay, ready? So now turn on the lights. The switch are on the right side.
Going into the mine now. There's big pipes here along the side. It's quite dark. We've all got our lamps on. Whew. It's getting lower now. Going down. Ow! I've just banged my head on the top of the tunnel. Oh! Oh, gosh. I don't know what that is. Oh, we're going under a cable now. Oh. What's the cable? Cables of electricity and air for... Ow! Oh! Just banged my head.
Are you okay?
Yeah. This is really low now. That's the air there for pneumatic drills. Oh God, it's really wet here and low. Oh, ow! I'm too tall. Going into a very small tunnel. Cable, rock. Oh. I'm bent double now. Ow! Oh. Going through a little wooden door. Oh no, this is interesting.
The devil, he's the mind's god. So there are thousand different statues of the devils like this. And his name is George.
Notice which says to be sold a cargo of 94 prime healthy Negroes consisting of 39 men, 15 boys, 24 women and 16 girls just arrived in the brigantine Dembia from Sierra Leone by David and John Deas. That's D-E-A-S. And then on the next notice it says, the main European nations directly involved in the transatlantic trade were Britain, Denmark, France, Netherlands, Portugal and Spain. Here we have a model of Francis Drake, who according to Bolivians was a famous English pirate. At 4,070 metres, Potosi is the highest city in the world. The cold climate and barren soil around the mines produce nothing more than a little issue. Straw, a very necessary fuel, but useless, but anything else. as there was no crops or trees within at least 6 hours' walk of the town. Everything had to be brought in from other areas. Potosi was a paradise for merchants, and goods were brought from all over the world. The immense wealth and desire for luxuries of its inhabitants seemed to know no bounds. Goods arrived from all over Europe and much further afield. Tapestries, mirrors, elaborate desks from Flanders, hats and woven textiles from England, glass from Venice, diamonds from Ceylon, rugs from Persia, Cairo, and Turkey. Food and supplies for the mines also arrived from great distances.
The shoots, look at the shoots outside the mines, like Indiana Jones, we are going to see the toilets as well. So after to transport the minerals here, they deposit in there into the shoots. And the shoots belong to different groups. Okay, get off the truck. Trolley now is coming.
There's an electric trolley coming along. These are trucks full of...
This is different groups. This is a big group, this is a small group. Those are the minerals, look at that.
Okay, so what are the trucks full of?
Sorry?
What are the trucks full of?
This complex mineral mix.
Mixed metal.
These are the minerals, complejo. Mineral mix, zinc, silver, lead. But this belongs to different groups.
So they're throwing the complejo into the chutes, and each chute belongs to a different group.
They transport down to the refining plants by trucks.
So there's guys in the chutes that break the big bits into smaller bits, and this is going to be transported by truck down to the refining plant.
The small groups are still pushing and pulling the trolleys, but the big groups, electric wagons like that, look at that.
Mine!
Now the mines are mining different minerals. Now the mines are mining complejo. Complejo is a combination of two or different minerals. Now the mines are mining zinc mixed with silver, lead, stone, rocks, waste is mineral mix, mineral ore. It's like ensalada de frutas, okay? But now the mines are mining mostly zinc, no silver. According to some engineers, geologists, probably as much silver remained in the mines in that mountain as has ever been extracted. That's why now the group's mines are going and down, deeper and deeper. Don't go up, because there are minerals to go up. So now they are going down and down, thinking to find good mineral veins, maybe silver, to be rich. 5 years ago, Emilio Labe, now which is one of the richest miners, 5 years ago, found one of the principal mineral veins, 2 meters wide of native silver, 100% silver. Imagine, it's by luck. Well, they are organizing in teams, in groups. There are big groups and small groups. Yeah, they are. So if the group find a good miner, it's for all the group. But if the mines work along, it's for only for the miner. There is a hierarchy working the mines. We have assistants, second hands, and leaders. So the leaders are the first class miners working in the mines. And the leads, they rent the place, the areas from the government. Because that mountain belongs to the government, and the leaders, they rent the place areas from the government, and they have to pay taxes to the government. So the leaders decide everything in the groups in the mines, so they are the first class of mines. If the mines are not leaders, nothing. To become a leader, there is a rule. The rule says if someone to become a leader, have stay working or must stay working in the same group, in the same mine, for 10 to 15 years before to become a leader. It's like this. In the same group, in the same mine. If they change to work in different groups or mines, they have to start again from the bottom. All their life. But there are some exceptions. Accidents or problems, yes, with the silicosis, accidents, different reasons. Gases, accidents with explosions. This is the finding plants. there are 35 different refining plants around this area.
And who do they belong to?
To the most of the owners are politicians.
In your government?
Yes. Also, there are some foreigner companies, some Canadian companies, American, English, Australian. Maybe you know the Australian company is Rio Tinto Zinc. And that's why the miners, after to extract the minerals, themselves have to see to choose to which company to sell their minerals. And the miners sell the minerals in tons, not in kilos. Always 10, 20 tons. That's why in their working places, first they have to make explosives to extract the minerals and to accumulate 10 or 20 tons. Then they transport outside the mines to sell to these private companies. But there are 35. That's why themselves have to see to choose to which owner to sell the minerals. Because between these companies, there is corruption as well, exists corruption. But you know, Bolivia is a corrupt country. We are the second most corrupt country in the world. When the minerals are down here, the 10 or 20 tons, the miners and buyers first together to know the quality have to take samples of the minerals. Because they know that there are minerals, zinc, silver, lead, but don't know how much percent. That's why down here they take samples to send them to the chemical laboratories to analyze the minerals. After to analyze, they know exactly how much percentage of silver, zinc, lead. When they know, the owners of these companies pay to the miners. That's why the miners earn according to the minerals, quality and quantity. Also, the owners of these companies pay to the miners according to the mineral prices. But we don't have the control for mineral prices in Bolivia. The mineral price come already here from the international market. We call this La Bolsa de Valores, the commodity market. That's why the miners sell and buy according to this mineral price. But since the financial crisis,
that we have, crisis.
Yes, the mineral price are dropping, going down as well.
So it's harder for the miners.
That's why it's a big problem for them. That's why now there are less miners than 2 years ago. So 2 years ago, according to the last statistics, there were more than 15,000 miners. Now there are less because mineral prices are going down, dropping. But these miners are thinking maybe this or next year again, the mineral prices are going to increase, get high, but we don't know. So we don't have the control here.
How are the companies corrupt?
That's why they have to be together, always together. If the miners are not watching when they are taking the samples, maybe the people of these companies put a lot of waste, so the quality is less. They take three packets. They have three packets, small ones. One packet is for the miner, for the group. The other packet is for the owner of the company. And the third packet stay in case, because if they don't have good coordination in the results after to analyze, they have to send the third packet to La Paz. That's why first they have to analyze the minerals, to know how much percentage of silver, zinc, lead. Then they pay to the miners. These companies pay to the miners. Maybe now 120 tons every day. Before it was more, 4,000 tons.
Now
a day. Top of that mountain has now 4,800 meters above the sea level. But before, the altitude was 5,800. 1,000 meters less because the mines extract the minerals. There are cavings as well. So that mountain is sinking. Like 10 years ago, the government wanted to work in that mountain, like in Chile, Chuquicamata, to make open pits, open cast, to start from the top. Right. But people didn't allow it. Miners didn't allow it. Because that mountain is our patrimony for us. So if the government is going to work there to introduce machines like this, that mountain is going to disappear immediately. That's no good for us, because if that mountain is going to disappear, Potosi is going to be like ghost town, ghost city. Because only mines here, we don't have only mines here, and Potosi is the biggest mining city in Bolivia. Only mines. Also, many businesses down in the city are connected with those mines.
That was part two of the report from the Candelaria mine at the Unificada Cooperative in Potosi, Bolivia. And I try saying that after a couple of points. 15% of the price of tours is donated to the miners, plus gifts from the miners' shops, such as dynamite, bottled drinks and equipment paid for by the tourists. You can hear more on South America in next week's show.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
June Wentland is here back in the studio, and she's now here, I believe, to read one of your very own short stories.
That's right.
What's it called?
It's called Legs 11. It was exactly 11 months after Helen had walked out on him that the doorbell rang and Peter found a leg on his front doorstep. It was a shapely female leg, just standing there and completely unaccompanied by any other body parts. Peter peered all around, but the street was eerily still under a slight dusting of March snow. There was one small set of single footprints leading towards his front door, where the leg stood, waiting. He picked the leg up and took it inside. The plastic material from which it was made was warm, like living flesh. It gave slightly under his touch, and his fingerprints remained visible, pink, for a few minutes on the creamy white of the calf. He placed it in an armchair at the side of the fireplace, and his eyes were drawn to it now and then while he watched TV. When the film finished, he had to restrain himself from saying goodnight to it, as it seemed to lean towards him expectantly as he got up to go to bed. He had a disturbed night's sleep. He dreamed of the leg hopping up the stairs and jumping onto his bed. In the morning, he was alarmed to find that the leg was actually lying next to him. The only explanation was that during his restless sleep, he'd gone downstairs and carried it up, though why he'd done such a thing, he couldn't imagine. Before Peter left for work, he took the leg off the bed and stood it next to the chest of drawers. Several times while he was at work, he caught himself wondering what the leg was getting up to, and then had to remind himself that it was just a dummy leg and couldn't get up to anything. But he had the unnerving feeling that it would be back in his bed when he got home, this time under the duvet. His hands shook as he opened the bedroom door. The leg was where he'd left it. But strangely, one of Helen's shoes that she'd forgotten to take when she moved out lay on the floor near the wardrobe, as if it had been hurriedly kicked off. Looking from the discarded shoe to the leg, Peter felt slightly sick. He put the shoe back in the wardrobe. Perhaps it had fallen out when he'd opened the door in the morning. He took the leg back downstairs with him. He preferred to keep his eye on it rather than worry about what it might be doing while his back was turned. Deciding that something would have to be done, he walked down the street to the late-night store with a leg in a dustbin liner tucked under his arm. He placed an advert on the shop notice board under Found. It just said Leg and his phone number. He pinned it firmly onto the cork surface. The next day, he put the leg back in the bin liner and into the boot of his car, but each time he looked out of his office window and into the car park, he was sure he could see the car trembling slightly as if the leg was kicking. Over the next 2 weeks, there was only one response to his advert on the shop notice board, a voice of mock desperation saying the leg belonged to the caller and he needed it back urgently because he didn't have a leg to stand on. It was accompanied by a lot of laughter. To take his mind off the leg, Peter joined an evening class to learn furniture making. The resulting coffee table was very accomplished for a beginner, but at what stage he decided to provide it with four shapely female legs that made it such an unusual item of living room furniture, he couldn't remember. He'd never bet on the horses before, but he started going down to the bookies at lunchtime, where he put a bet on horses that had any name vaguely connected with legs. Legs 11 sounded so much like a lucky omen that he couldn't resist, but even as he handed the money over, he'd decided that it could only lose. That evening, in an attempt to distract himself, he invited Rachel, a work colleague, over to watch a DVD and share a bottle of wine with him. He'd shut the leg in the wardrobe before she arrived, but every time there was a silence in the movie, he was sure he could hear the sort of muffled shouts that might come from an enraged limb. After Rachel had gone, Peter brought down the leg and one of Helen's shoes. The shoe fitted the leg perfectly. Peter stared at it, wondering why he'd done it. Is this what repeatedly dissecting his past with Helen had brought him to? He was worn out by the mental surgical procedures on the failed relationship. He snatched the shoe off the foot, threw the leg back in the bin liner, added two bricks from the shed, and then tied the bag up. He drove to the river, stood on the bank, counted to 10, and on 11 threw the leg in. It sank slowly beneath the cold, dark water. As he arrived back at his garden gate, he was half expecting the leg to be there already, dripping, wet and vengeful, but it wasn't. There were two legs standing on the doorstep, and they were attached to the rest of a body, Helen's body. "I've been thinking," said Helen, and she was smiling. But as Helen walked into the living room, one of her shoes was lying beneath the table next to two empty glasses, one smeared with Rachel's lipstick. "You've let some other woman wear my shoes," she said. "No," said Peter. "No, it was a leg, just a leg." As Helen left, Peter searched again, this time, hopefully, for something wet and limb-shaped that would prove the truth. But the garden was empty, apart from his discarded betting slip stuck to the concrete path. The clack of Helen's heels faded as she walked away. Peter wanted to run after her, but his legs felt disembodied, separate, as if a cold, dark weight of water held them down.
Thank you very much. Would you like to come back in the next few weeks, perhaps, and read another?
Yeah, sure. That'd be great.
Brilliant. I'll look forward to it.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Grinning figure in black is seated next to me, which can only mean Jeff Sparks is ready and waiting to deliver the very latest in What's On in Bristol.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is a What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 12th of March, and at the Thunderbolt in Bristol, the She Creatures will be performing. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance and £7 on the door. Moving on to Friday, 13th of March, and at Mr. Wolf's in Bristol, Emily Breeze will be performing with support from Howlin' Lord and also Dirty Roger. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week, and this week I feature Flash Harry. This is from the album Who's Harry, and it's a track titled Sword of Light. Tighter than you should.
God is flesh and blood.
That was Flash Harry with Sword of Light from the album Who's Harry. For more information on them, you can check out www.myspace.com/Flash Harry Band. Or you can go and see them on Saturday 14th of March when they'll be performing at the Prom Bar in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Also on 14th of March and at the Old Duke in Bristol, Dynamos Rhythm Aces will be performing. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Sunday 15th of March and at the Thunderbolt in Bristol, the Blue Aeroplanes will be performing. Tickets are £10 in advance and £12 on the door. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, here's a fascinating fact. One of the she creature's fathers is a man named John Dufflow, who was the piano player in the Quarrymen, which was what the Beatles were before there were the Beatles. And John Dufflow worked at the Smith & Williamson accountancy firm where I work. 6 degrees of separation, or what? Also on, this may be possibly past the time that you are in, wherever you are listening to this, but this Friday, the 6th of March, at the Croft, the Illegal Seagull Night is taking place, where, amongst many other bands, Duran 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 are performing, who used to be played on the John Peel show many years ago. I don't know what they're like these days, but that might be worth it. That's the end of this week's show. Dialect Radio from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based right here in the city centre. Today's studio guest was Simon Chapman. The feature on the Gaza Convoy was brought to us by Tony Gosling, and of course we wish Mohammed El Haddad continuing good luck. Our guest musician was Rachel Evanson, and thank you to June Wentland for the short story. Malcolm Grieve read another instalment of The History of the Mafia, and the Potosi Mine feature was recorded and edited by Anthea Page. Jeff Sparks gave us his What Song Guide, and Village Church Curran was the studio engineer. This week's show was produced by Anthea Page. You can download the show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. You can email us from Bristol Radio Co-op, that's all one word, at hotmail.co.uk. And next week, Tim Elliott from the Amnesty talking about the China and Tibet situation in the wake of the National Demo and March Free Tibet, which takes place in London on the 7th of March. And there'll be part 3 of the Princess Di interview. It's goodbye from all of us here, so take care of yourselves. Goodbye.